Hello, I'm Henry Shelford, CEO, co-founder of ADHD UK. And today we're doing a deep dive into the major pharmaceutical treatments for ADHD. It's obviously a big topic. It's what do they do? How do they work? And I'm delighted to have Dr. Mashru here again, who's doing these deep dives with me to talk it through. Hello.
Hello again. Hi, Henry. How are you?
Oh, great, thank you. Right, we're going to just start with the big question. Why? Why do people take ADHD medication? What does it do? And what does it do particularly for the symptoms for people with ADHD?
Good. So, yes, obviously a very big topic. Looking forward to this one. In terms of medication, helping with ADHD symptoms. I think the first question then is, well, what kind of symptoms are we looking to treat? Broadly speaking, I see an improvement in three categories of symptoms in most patients. The first category would be what would be called the inattentive symptoms of ADHD. So improvement in task initiation with less procrastination, in overall improvement with productivity with tasks. Improvement in sustaining attention on one task at a time, as opposed to sort of being distracted by other things and jumping around from one task to the other. Also, an improvement in what's called executive function. So things like being a bit more aware of time. So time management can improve. Organization, therefore, can improve. You're more likely to sort of be actioning things on your to-do list. Putting things in your diary, kind of thing. Working memory can also improve to an extent, but in my experience, that's probably one of the hardest symptoms to actually treat and in terms of medication. And maybe we'll talk about this later on, but of course, medication alone is not the only answer, right? The old adage, pills don't create skills, is absolutely fundamentally true in my experience in ADHD. And so developing good habits, perhaps with a coach, can better area in better help in those symptoms. The other category of symptoms that I generally see an improvement in is a reduction of what's called hyperactivity and impulsivity symptoms. Patients describe feeling internally calmer. So that might be perceived as being less fidgety, less restless, able to sit through your work meeting, able to sit through your university lecture, and also impulsivity can improve. So when you're feeling internally calmer and your thoughts are not going at 100 miles an hour with lots of different thoughts going on, and I want to say this and I want to say that, that can show in conversations. So I've had people tell me that their partner or their work colleagues have noticed that they're more attentive in conversations, basically more present, that they're not going off on tangents as much, and they're actually listening better to what the person is saying. Impulsivity can also manifest, of course, in other habits, which I have worked with many patients, and that's improved. So, and this is not, I'm not saying this is for the, for all patients, but I've worked with patients, for example, who have used substances or alcohol to help manage their symptoms. And over a period of time, they've actually managed to come off the sims to the substances rather, and not using alcohol in such a sort of regular way. And medication has helped in that area. And then the final category of, well, they're not, I mean, we know from our last talk actually on emotional dysregulation, they're not currently classed in the diagnostic criteria, but a massive area of improvement that I see in individuals is a reduction in feeling so emotionally overwhelmed if you're medicated correctly. And this is sometimes the most powerful impact, even more than the attention and concentration. Patients will tell me, look, I've been on a history of antidepressants that have not managed to make me feel emotionally calmer and happier. And that can actually sometimes be, for a patient, subjectively their most biggest area of impact with medication.
No, thank you. It's an important you know, it's so important to talk around, you know, the symptoms. And what do you say to people who go, well, everyone could do with a bit of that? There's genuinely an article in a newspaper in the last few weeks comparing our use of ADHD medication to the Nazi Party's use of amphetamines. Your response, please.
Yeah, so obviously, my first response would be, why would you want to take anything into your system unless you really needed it? Yeah. And we'll probably talk about this as well, but medication, of course, comes with its own risks and side effects. When you're being
the phrase I use is every pill has its price. Like it's,
yeah,
it comes with a cost and that you have to consider.
Yeah. And this also then comes to the point of, you know, in terms of prescribing, you really need to see an expert. First of all, you see the expert to understand whether you have the diagnosis and whether medication is appropriate, because I don't necessarily recommend medication to every single client of mine, even if they are diagnosed. I might actually say, no, I think you'd be better off. You're more psychologically minded. I think you might be better off going down the coaching route first, you know, rather than jumping to medication immediately. But in a response to that, I just cannot understand why anyone would want to take medications, because what if they don't need to? Because what will happen is, over time, certainly, the side effects are going to far outweigh any sort of minor benefit that you're going to get if you don't genuinely have the condition that medication is used to treat.
So what's I think obviously the issue is that there are some people taking the related chemicals recreationally. And that has then provided quite a lot of stigma around us taking them in a therapeutic effect. So like, how do you, like you just talked about, like what's it different for someone without ADHD? What happens if they take ADHD medication? Like what do you see then?
Not a hell of a lot, in all honesty. So at the most, you might see is it's like taking a coffee, you know, really, in terms of the impact. A very slight increase in focus for a short, very brief period of time, and that's really about it. When you give ADHD medication,
and that's because it's not, that person doesn't have an area of the brain that needs additional stimulation. It's already appropriately stimulated, so they're not going to see that differential effect. Is that right?
Actually, to be honest, what you might see is a level of agitation, because you got to put the dopamine and the noradrenaline levels that stimulants provide you into overdrive, because they weren't low, yeah? So you'll see a level of your sympathetic nervous system getting overly activated, and actually it's not going to be a very pleasant experience. You're going to feel irritable and agitated on edge. And actually, if you you know, it's going to invoke symptoms that you probably didn't have.
Yeah, and certainly I'm been told of a study around people taking ADHD medication with regards to exams, people who don't need it, and actually having a negative impact on their studying and their exam performance. So it's not this sort of enhancer for everyone that is sometimes portrayed. You know, when I first took medication, I rather hoped it was going to be rather like the movie Limitless. Yeah. The guy takes his medication every day and suddenly great memory, great focus, achieving little things. Why not coaching first? You mentioned coaching, and something we need to iterate is that this is a two-parter. So this is we're doing pharmaceutical interventions in this one, and we're going to be doing non-pharmaceutical interventions in the next one. It's important to cover both, but two very big topics. But why not coach first? Like, why doesn't everyone just go force through a coaching avenue first? And if that doesn't work, then medication.
Right. So I think in terms of that, for in my case, what I would do is I would see the patient that's sitting in front of me, right? I don't like to go down the whole pathway of do step one, then you do step two, then you do step three. Right, because that doesn't work for every single person. And ADHD is a spectrum condition, and people can present in quite different ways, different severities, different levels of impairment. So I look at the person in front of me. So as an example, if I have a patient who is already fairly opposed to medication, right? And they are what's called psychologically minded. You can see this in a long enough assessment. If someone's quite reflective, if someone is open to, you know, hearing sort of comments or strategies where you think they can improve on, that kind of patient, I think, would do well with a coach initially, especially before giving them medication, because psychologically they already might have certain fears about medication, etc., and they actually might be more empowered to go down the coaching route. These kind of patients might have already started looking into things. So they've started improving their lifestyle, exercise. You know, they've joined forums or groups like this one, for example, to try and understand more about their condition. So they're very psychologically minded. That type of patient could do really well with a coach initially, and they may never need medication. However, I might get another patient who is really severely impaired. It's having detrimental effects everywhere in their life. So in their relationships, at their work, it's had horrendous effects in education. They've maybe tried lots of different medications like antidepressants. They've tried talking therapies. They'll come to me and say, I have tried everything under the sun and I'm absolutely desperate. They score massively on their symptom scales as well. That kind of patient, I definitely, as per the sort of NICE guidance, the national guidance, I would recommend medication, you know, as a first option. But even in that case, I would still recommend adjunctive coaching if they can, alongside the medication. And typically what I would do is I'd actually start their medication first, let them be on their medication for 2 to 3 months so that they can see a significant improvement in their symptoms and their functioning, and then introduce the coach, because at that point, I think they would take on more from their coaching sessions, actually.
And I think that's the critical thing. So when we look at the different paths that people take after a diagnosis, you see people opting for medication. You see people opting not to, for either doesn't work for them. And we know that it has a positive impact on about 80% of people, is my understanding of the numbers. But then you have an impact around issue around side impacts, and studies vary in sort of long-term adherence to medication. And I see numbers between about 50 and 75%, which talks to the third path, which is people opting for medication, using the support that it gives them to then learn the tools, the strategies, find the products that lighten the load and make a difference for them at the point where they're like, well, now I want to just do that and I don't want medication, and that's the path I want to go down. So those three paths of medication for a longer time, and that can be lifelong, medication for a while to use and find yourself in a place where you don't want it anymore and feel you don't need it, and no medication at all. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, for any, you know, expert that people go to see, or any clinician, this should not be taken as a, it's not a recipe cookbook. You know, this is how you make chocolate cake. You put this bit ingredient in, then you put that ingredient in. You have to look at the person that's in front of you and tailor it according to them, right?
One of the ways we talk about it is we just say everyone is a unique individual plus ADHD. Yeah. And so you can't look at everything and go, like, there is no one size fits all approach. People are themselves unique, but doing a particular job in a particular situation at a particular life point, like, there's a lot Absolutely. To make those different. I had someone come to me very recently and say, I don't want to take ADHD medication. Is there a supplement that does something similar?
So there's, I went to a conference, a CADRA conference, about this, actually, about this very subject, a couple of years ago. So it's, you know, pretty recent. And it was all about non-pharmacological approaches to medication, right? So obviously coaching was a big part of that. Then there was lifestyle measures and supplements, etc. Now, that conference had all the big research bods in there. They collated lots of studies across thousands of people. And essentially, the bottom line of the finding was that the only, apart from coaching, the only non-pharmacological or non-medical or non-medication pathway that showed statistically significant improvement in ADHD symptoms was actually exercise. And that too, aerobic high-intensity exercise. So they're quite specific about it. What they found, however, is that many of the supplements might be producing, at least initially, very strong placebo effects, which is actually not something to be discounted in mental health. Because if for the person, and again, it's going back to the individual now, taking that supplement genuinely shows an improvement for them, then that is great. I've had some patients, so I'm giving now anecdotal cases, where they might say, for example, magnesium supplements help them with sleep. And magnesium supplements have helped with certain side effects of medication that they might have had, like jaw grinding or teeth grinding. And I have definitely heard that. But the science behind it was showing more about it perhaps being placebo, but that's not a bad thing either.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I think, so when I was asked the question, like, is there a supplement that does something similar? My answer was significantly less graceful. which is just like, I mean, and that's partly because we obviously have a number of online support groups and online forums, and we just get spammed every day with nonsense supplements being tried to be sold. Like, and they follow fashions, but like, you know, it's ginkgo biloba, CBD, what else is that? The list goes on.
Actually, on that note, though, CBD has shown effectiveness in something else, which is particularly around anxiety symptoms.
Honestly, I already regret saying that, because CBD's had this problem that it wasn't as a pharmaceutical, wasn't investigated for many years. What's known to, obviously known to have impacts. Yeah. I think the thing to say is that the CBD that you can buy in Holland and Barrett is a very, very low percentage, and not one that, as I understand it, has been shown to have any kind of validity at all in anything. But that's as I understand it. I feel like I'm stepping outside of my area of any of expertise. I think we get spammed by people just selling stuff and making up whatever they fancy, and so it makes me very, very nervous on and then when you're talking to the placebo effect, you've then got this problem. You've got people who are having a positive impact, but it's placebo impact, but they're telling everyone it's a miracle.
Well, the thing with the placebo effect is that over time it will really reveal itself. And what that means is, over time, people will find that actually, I don't think this is doing that much.
No, fair enough. We talked about why not coaching immediately. You talked about sort of taking the person in the room, making a decision. I did want to talk about why coaching has such an impact. And for me, I think the core of it is you're working with someone who has a deep understanding of ADHD, probably has ADHD themselves, and you're building up one-to-one, in a one-to-one discussion, bespoke things to make a difference for you. So you're working on the issues that are biggest for you and solutions, strategies that are going to make a difference for you. And that's why it's so impactful, because it is that sort of bespoke approach to help you build those things up. Does that sound sort of what you think as well?
I mean, add to that? Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, you probably have more expertise on coaching than I do, but I mean, I describe it to patients, and you might berate me for this, but I describe it to patients a bit like personal training for your another element of life, right? It's like having that, right? So, and I think in ADHD, if you look at the nature of ADHD, how beneficial is it to have that weekly check-in and skills? I think that's really important in ADHD. It's the fundamental nature, right, of the forgetfulness and going back to old ways, etc. But if you always have that, you know, regular input as well. I think that can, over time, lead to better habits.
It's an interesting aspect as well, the other regular being able to speak to someone. You also talked about substance abuse, which I want to just come back to quickly, because something some people will find and get very worried about is the idea that if you've got an issue with substance abuse, that the medication pathway is not an option for you. And you've just said the opposite, so where you've said that in some cases where, and this is something we also see, where people recognize that the support of medication that it gives then allows someone to conquer those substance abuse issues, but without it, the history is that they struggle to do that. And
so let me just add a bit of information into the substance misuse one. So there's a lot of data that shows that ADHD medication given to patients with substance misuse greatly increases the chances of abstinence from substances. Yeah. And if we look at, funny enough, I was just in a lecture about this just yesterday. So if we look at individuals who are in substance misuse services, right, where substance misuse has been a sort of a prominent problem for most of their life, about 30% of those patients will have ADHD, which is huge.
Right? Wow, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so this, the 30%, so about one in three, that's massive, right? So then there has been
For whom the current sort of strategies aren't working because... Oh,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. For them. So when we look at managing a patient with substance misuse, with heavy substance misuse, active substance misuse histories, the choice of medication is very important here, right? So with stimulants, you have what's called long-acting medications and short-acting medications, right? And I'm sure a lot of your audience are going to know about this anyway, but I'm going to go into it briefly. So long-acting medications are made as what's called a prodrug. Okay, so lisdexamfetamine is a prodrug. And what that means bluntly is if you break open a capsule of lisdexamfetamine and try to snort it, you're just going to get an itchy nose and sneeze. You're going to get absolutely no euphoric effects from it because it has to be taken into your system, broken down, and then you start getting the effects of the medication. So the guidance around managing patients who have had substance misuse histories is that they should always have long-acting medications, not short-acting medications, where there's a risk of abuse potential and it can almost feel like they're taking a euphoric substance, and that in itself can increase the risk of them using again as in illicit substances. So long-acting medications is the solution over time, and that can be done very safely. I've done this with many patients. So if they're willing, even with urine drug testing, for example, which sounds a bit heavy, but of course there is a risk of certain substances, particularly like cocaine. If you take that with stimulants, it can increase the pressure on your heart. So over time, and I've done this with many patients, actually, people who are motivated, obviously, but if they're coming to see me, they probably are motivated. They've actually, over time, completely come off their cocaine use, etc. And what they were doing was they were self-medicating. So one thing I ask in my when I'm doing a diagnostic assessment is, I obviously ask about drugs and alcohol history. And if they tell me, yeah, I've got a history of using cocaine, I'll ask them, well, what does that do for you? And the telltale sign is they'll say something like, it's completely different to my mates who take it. I say, well, what do you mean by that? And they'll say, well, I ended up just falling asleep in the toilet, in the nightclub toilet. It actually made me so calm and relaxed, I just fell asleep. If you speak to anyone else who, you know, uses cocaine, it is going to keep you wired and keep you wide awake till, you know, the next day, etc. So that's quite an interesting one, because it's called a paradoxical effect. Essentially, certain drugs will have a paradoxical effect on patients with ADHD because it's mimicking, but not entirely, some elements of what the medication is doing. And these people will have often, initially at least, been using such substances to help manage their ADHD symptoms, which they didn't know they had.
It's a big deal. Like, and I spoke to someone recently who had substance abuse issues, but they were using the substances to manage their ADHD. They recognized that it provided them with that calmed their brain, allowed them to do things, and they were struggling. They went to get help to their GP. They're on a wait list and it was a long wait, and they said, like, I really need help now. They talked about their substance abuse issue and how they were using the substance. And the GP had to say, look, there's nothing I can do in terms of accelerating you on the wait time, but you have a family, and as such, I now have an obligation to report this to social services. And that's going to crystallize an investigation, which is when I met them. And they're based in England, so we were able to direct them to Right to Choose and also make sure they were seen very, very fast indeed. So the place they went to, with a little bit of help, saw them within about 4 days, which was absolutely incredible. And then looked to provide support in exactly as you were, which did include medication. I think the important messages people need to hear is that if you have a substance abuse issue, it doesn't mean that you can't opt for medication and get the support if that is clinically appropriate in the eyes of your professional. I think a lot of people can think that door is just completely closed to them.
And I think also another important point to make is, and this is for the audience out there, a good provider should also work with other professionals. So what that means is, if they're part of a substance misuse service already, they shouldn't be working in silo. They should work with that person's key worker, for example. That's really
that's a good point. So I hear you. Like, that does assume a system that's working together, which I think we can all know is not factual everywhere in the country. That's putting it mildly. But I hear you. And I think that point of working across with different professionals is really important. So we are people watching. So we are going to go into the detail of different medications. But what we're trying to do is talk through the general first. What do you do about people talking about the first time they got on medication? So I've seen people fall into a trap on this. So, talk to me what you see and what you do.
Okay. So you see different trajectories here of when people start medication. One of them will be, oh, the first few days I took medication, it was magic. I felt immediate clarity of my thinking. I was getting everything done. I was more amiable to be around. Everyone noticed the change. But then after a week, it stopped working. And I don't think they're working anymore, doctor. So that's one that you hear. The other one, when you're starting a titration, if you're starting at a low dose, they may tell you, I didn't really feel very much at all, actually. Maybe a couple of hours of impact and then nothing at all. And then the third one is that they had good benefit throughout the month. However, they felt that over the course of the month, the medication didn't last as long as it did when they first started it in the first week. Those are the general trajectories that you hear about medication. And I can talk to that if you want to, Henry.
Yeah, that'd be great. You can talk about how you talk to each of those people.
So, first chap or lady who will say the first 2-3 days were amazing and then it didn't really do much at all. The ADHD brain has been surviving in a climate of low dopamine and low noradrenaline for X many years, right? And the first time you introduce, a stimulant medication that increases the dopamine and noradrenaline, it is like, wow. So I'm going to use a glasses analogy, which I'm going to probably use a lot when I talk about medication. when you spent your whole life, well, there you go, right? So when you spent your whole life sort of going along with not 20/20 vision, etc., you're used to squinting at things or whatever, suddenly you put those glasses on for the first time, it's like, wow, this is so clear. Is that what that's supposed to look like? Is this how the world is supposed to look, right? And should it be this effortless for people? It's unbelievable. Now, when you first start at the low dose, so now let's go to the optician's chair, you know, when they're trying to figure out your number. So they're doing, is it clearer with one or with two, right? And they keep notching up they change the lens accordingly. Even at the lowest dose, because you've had maybe, you know, really poor vision, right? You can still notice that difference, right? But then you slightly change the lens, and there's a certain point in that eye test where you're like, I'm not really sure if one or two was better. I don't really know. Can you go back and all that kind of thing? That's the same kind of analogy with medication. And the real aim of what's called a titration is not to produce miraculous effects. The aim is that it gives you glasses for the whole period of the day into the evening. So as long as effect as possible without incurring too many side effects. Because obviously as you build up the dose, you increase the risk of side effects. It's a bit like that.
The issue I've seen is people chasing that, like nothing feels like that. So therefore what I'm on can't be right.
Yeah. So with those patients, and this happens a lot, right? Sometimes, I mean, provided it's safe to do so, I will tell them, well, why don't you take a medication break for 2 weeks? And then after time, very quickly, actually, they'll be like, oh, no, hang on. Okay, there is it is definitely doing something.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, like I've recently, as in yesterday, come up with a new metaphor, which I know doesn't work, but let's give it a go, which is when you first take medication, it's like you're in a car and you're joining the motorway and you've got that acceleration as you get to that same speed as everyone else. But then once you start cruising in that first lane at 60 miles an hour, whatever it is, you start to then notice like that your car's a bit shabby or the bumps or the knocking noises, and you're trying to say, oh, I want to go back to how it felt like when I was accelerating joining this path, but you can't, because that was a one-off. But and now you've got to work out what to do now. The problem with it is it involves speed and the derivative drug here for many is amphetamines, and it's just not a great place for us to go. But it feels like it actually communicates it quite well. Like, yeah, what have you used? Should I use it more? Or like,
I think what you want to do, the aim of a titration of medication is to get you to a good steady state where there is an improvement, and it's almost actually that improvement is always there, as opposed to bang, like a big crash bang effect. That's not. Even people who are not on medication are not experiencing that in their day, are they? Do you see what I mean? That's not how life is, right? And I also want to give like sort of realistic expectations about medication at this point, actually, because you mentioned about the limitless pill, which I've heard patients... Which
is not, sadly, very, very sadly.
You're not. And to be quite frank, I tell patients, listen, the world doesn't suddenly become rosy, right? The things that you found boring, you're not going to suddenly find them interesting. You just get on with it. You're able to do them because they have to be done. And there's that impetus there that needs to be done. You don't suddenly look at your tax return and say, wow, these are so fascinating. I never saw the beauty of doing tax return. That's not what happens, right? You're just like, okay, well...
Unless, you know, unique person plus ADHD, there's going to be someone who was like, right, time, I need to retrain as a tax accountant.
Generally, what I'm saying is, and this is what we came to from the beginning, actually, your personality is your personality. So I think this is maybe something that might be brought up. I get asked this question a lot. Are the medications going to change my personality? No. you know, is the answer. You're still going to like what you liked and you're still going to not like what you didn't like, right? It's just with those certain things that you've struggled with that had to be done, but you've always put them off or things like it will help with those areas, right? And of course, as I say, beyond the normal traditional ADHD symptoms, 100% it can help with emotional regulation too. But it doesn't change you into a robot, if you know, or that kind of thing.
What about creativity? A lot of people worry, like, my creativity is going to go. What do you say to that?
I get that one all the time. I've had many creative people that I've seen. No, I've not experienced that, actually. I haven't.
Look, I opt for medication, and my personal opinion is that my number of creative ideas doesn't change, but my ability to do them does.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that sticking to things and seeing it through, that's what you want to see an improvement in. Where a coach helps as well, obviously, not just meds. But I've not seen that. I've not heard people tell me that, oh, you know, I feel creatively dumbed down or anything like that. No,
the only place that I've met a number of celebrities, sort of particularly television personalities, who opt not to take medication on screening days, on filming days. And that is an area where I'm like, I could see why, for making engaging television, you want the impulsivity aspect that's got you to this point. And I could see one, why you'd be nervous to change that because you've got your success. But also I can see why you might want that sort of impulsivity and energy, and that might be part of your on-screen trademark and wanting it.
Well, interestingly, so this raises a different topic, actually. Sorry, these might come up as questions.
This is an ADHD meeting, like jumping around. We're totally up for. Not a problem. As long as someone's taking notes and keeping us back on track, which unfortunately in this scenario is me, the one with the ADHD. Not you, the one without.
No, but interesting. So there is a lot of research which is showing that ADHD medication can pronounce certain autistic traits.
You know what? That was my next question, because when you talked about not changing personality, I was like, let's talk about where you've got coexisting conditions.
Now, the telltale again for this one is when patients will say, do you know what, one thing I'm not liking about this medication is it's making me socially more introverted. I'm sort of finding that I'm withdrawing into myself more. So I'm aware of the conversation and I can focus on it, but I'm actually contributing to it less, and I'm not that I'm not just blurting out things, I'm not saying things as much. I'm going quieter. When we look at ADHD and autism, they're almost two sides of a coin. And that there is some evidence that stimulant medication in particular can pronounce some of those social communication difficulties traits that might be in comorbid autism. And then people withdraw into the inner world more. There is a risk of that.
I think that's an important thing. Certainly I've spoken to people who've said like they feel that their autistic traits become more pronounced, and whether that's because the ADHD traits are masking them or causing, you know, for example, that I thought that social introversion and talking out was a really good example, where with ADHD you're more likely to jump in and say stuff, that aspect would, you could see clearly masking, meaning that a lack of desire to speak in gets covered up because you are.
Absolutely. So where before you had something that was almost balancing that, you've taken one of them away and then you're left with the more socially, sort of social introversion, right?
Yeah.
And in autism, there is a tendency and you see this more, I guess, with children as well, but a tendency to go into your inner world a lot, right? It's being called as shutdowns and, you know, et cetera, but tendency to do that. And that might sort of put a magnifying glass on that tendency in some people. So I think the history taking is very important in these situations, because in in true just ADHD alone, they'll say, oh, no, I was actually really present in conversation. So I wasn't inappropriately saying things, but I could engage in a really appropriate way. I knew when it was my time to come in, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in the autism, sort of the comorbid autistic traits side, they might say, you know, people have been telling me I've gone a lot quieter, actually. And I don't even feel like engaging as much at all in conversation. It's a slightly different, it's a subtle difference, but it is a difference.
Interesting. And for people wanting to know a bit more about this topic in our video series, we actually, at the global conference, we had a doctor who has both autism and ADHD and did an entire segment talking about people with both. He called it ASD and ADHD, Order into Chaos in Symbiosis. A title that initially made me very nervous. I checked in with lots of people who went, I love it, order and chaos, you're describing me. So we went with it. But it's a nice piece, and I'd certainly recommend it. Right, I think we've covered the main sort of around the medication, and how many of the three kinds of people did we get through? Yeah, the people who take the medication and experience that first feeling.
Yeah, the people. So my explainer to those
people. I genuinely forgot who the other ones are.
Yeah, well,
I did not write it down.
Yeah. So the other group was, sorry, medication has been working really well at the beginning for a long period of time, but then over the month, it is wearing off quicker. That's very normal, right? Because you start at a lower dose, and those people just might need to be gradually titrated up in their dose, and it will last longer.
How do you reconcile ADHD medication people don't get a resistance to and don't get a tolerance to, they once they get to their level they're stable, versus in the early days going upwards?
It's about duration of treatment, right? So if I have seen someone who's been on meds for a few years and they're telling me, do you know what, now it's not lasting as long, that's tolerance. Yeah, that's tolerance, that's happening, and tolerance can happen.
Okay, it can happen, right?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly in my experience. But what I start
tolerance with, to the point where you no longer have effectiveness, like,
no, not to that level. Normally they will top out, so they'll be at a dose where there's a limit to how much the medication gives them. They certainly see an improvement. They definitely wouldn't want their meds to be taken away from them, but it's not as it was years ago. And this is where, again, where we originally spoke about coaching and strategies to help yourself, right? Learning strategies to help yourself is vital, because this is like many chronic conditions. It's like, you know, it's like diabetes, you know, exercise, diet, so many medications, there's so many different factors here, right? I will tell everyone, if you think like I'm going to just take a few pills and this is done, it's not. Yeah, so yeah. It's a whole multimodality approach to this,
yeah, which is absolutely, yeah, I think it is important for people to know. In terms of tolerance, how do you find that quite common, that people need adjusting as they get over time?
After many years, maybe, yeah. Yes, it can happen. And some people take what's called medication breaks. That can help. I use this with caution now, because again, I went to a recent conference. They said, I don't tell your patients to take medication breaks. I take this with a big pinch of salt, right? Because this is, again, going back to individual cases. So if I have, you know, if I have a patient who's a uni student and he'll say, look, I don't want to take it over the summer, right? I'm not doing any studies. I'm not, that to me, that's fine. Don't, you know, I mean, and unless your ADHD is so severely impacting you in every aspect of life.
Yeah.
If you didn't take it in the summer, you're not looking after yourself. And I'm, you know, that's a different story, right? But not everyone will need to take it over their summer break. You know, I don't fully agree with the model.
Summer breaks feel like a long time ago. Like, yeah. I think that, because that, like I've certainly had that, where people have been, got the impression, I should take a break every weekend, and then going, but you know, I've got a family, and actually that's I want to be present for them. I want the support medication gives me so I can be a better parent or better family member. Like, and yeah, and so medication is not just for work, I think. It's
No. But it's more important what you said actually was, where are you at in your life? And what place are you at now, right? So what I'm trying to say is, you don't take the medication on the weekend. Your symptoms are coming back, but depends on where you are in your life and what you're doing on your weekend, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what I'm trying to...
Okay, back to our three people. So we've got the chasers of the how it felt first.
Yeah.
Which I think we've talked to basically try to relieve people of the idea that that's how medication succeeding works. You've got for people who get to a stable dose, we were just talking about the understanding why there's a sort of at the start page, there's a sort of it works, and then we need to work up to find our effective dose. Why does it feel like it's working and then you feel like you need to work up? What's going on?
So chemically to do with receptor occupation of the nerves in the brain, okay? So we're talking about dopamine and noradrenaline. You're living in a brain with low dopamine and low noradrenaline, right? To different degrees, right? And initially, you're bringing in a low concentration of a medication, therefore has lower effects on increasing dopamine and noradrenaline. So initially, your receptors are getting filled up with this nice dopamine and noradrenaline. But because it's a low dose, the stickiness, if you like, of that dopamine and noradrenaline to the receptor is not as potent. And then they start coming off again, and you're going back to original state of not enough. And as you build up the dose, the stickiness, if you like, of that dopamine and noradrenaline to the receptor and the amount of dopamine and noradrenaline that's produced makes it a more powerful effect. But depending on where your original baseline state was, you may or may not need to get to high doses of medication. So it's where you originally were in terms of your neurochemistry, when we're talking about medication now, that plays a role. But then if you look at the non-medical side again, which I'm going to emphasize, you know, if you are someone who is using a lot of non-medical tactics, coaching, strategies, all these other things to help you, you also may also not need to go to that higher dose of medication compared to that same person who might have been sort of not doing any of those things, socially isolated, you know, doesn't have any other support structures. You know, it's a combination of the sort of genetics of someone, their pharmacology, and their environment, right? Where the environment plays a big role. And this is for any chronic mental health condition, actually, not just ADHD, right? So there's a lot of factors.
And I'm going to use can't use it, but the motorway analogy is like you join the motorway, and after you've joined it for a while, you realize you're going 40. You're like this is... I'm clearly going slower than I could, and there's more capacity in me. But you only realize that after you've been there for a while. I need a better analogy, but like the problem is it works. It's working really well. So we've got our three person. We've got the chases of the first feeling. We've got the gradually rising to the appropriate dose. What's the third? Remind the audience,
I would put the category as the tolerance group. So you'll have patients that after a while will say, is this really doing anything for me anymore? Is it working? Right? And I think there's a remnant of them sort of, again, remembering what their original first few months of medication was like. Right.
And yeah. Your answer to them is be a scientist. Let's not take medication for a while and see how you feel. And like, if it's not having an impact, great. And if it is...
I need to put a disclaimer right here, because I don't want a bunch of people to suddenly stop their medication and dangerous things to happen. Yes. I say that with caution.
Yes, the disclaimer, yeah. we should put it in, which is obviously you need to... This is generic conversation and is not medical advice, and it is not you need to talk to your relevant medical qualified professional to work out exactly what's right for you.
I'll tell you what, you know, we're coming back again now, but we've had national stock shortages of medication, right? Between I think it was it September, and I can't remember now. It was about 6 months it went. Now, that is when people really realized what their medication was doing for them in a quite a brutal way, because have patients that I was seeing for annual reviews who would tell me, right, okay, this medication is definitely having an impact on my life because I've not been able to get it for the last month, and it's not good, right? So that's where we saw that, you know, and I saw that so many times.
And actually that gives an opportunity for an important question. So as I responded to that, one of my great things I was worried about was that people presenting, saying this medication makes a big difference to me, it's really important to me, looks a lot like addictive behavior. Needing to make sure that the media didn't respond to this going like, you know, we've got a whole load of addicts. Generally, we had an article not so long ago talking about comparing the increase in ADHD medication to the opioid crisis in the States. So, is ADHD medication addictive?
No, there's no physiological addiction as such, right? But I'm going to go back to analogies again, right? So when we look at addiction, right, there are certain criterion that we medically would class as dependence. We don't call it addiction as such, but in medically we call it dependence, right? One is cravings for that substance. And another big one then, number two, is withdrawal effects from that substance, right? So if you stopped your stimulant meds, you are going to probably feel knackered, wiped out, tired for about 1, 2, maximum 3 days generally. But then what you are going to notice is all of your ADHD symptoms come back. Yeah. You're not going to be generally fitting, shaking, seizuring, you know, that kind of effect. Yeah. Also, in general, I've never heard patients crave their medication. It's more like, I need to take my medication, as opposed to, gosh, I really could do, I really fancy another Lisdex amphetamine capsule right now. You know, I'm really craving that. Right. So it's not like that. What I would come back to is the glasses analogy, right? There is, if I took away your glasses, Henry, you're not going to start frothing and frothing at the mouth, but you're not going to enjoy that experience forever, right?
No, and if I've got lots of work on, I get pretty anxious if I can't find the things.
Absolutely. I guess it's more about, it can, of course, it enhances your life to a level where it's helped you with the areas you were struggling with, right? So why would you then not want to have your glasses on anymore? So it's more that kind of effect, you know, as opposed to an addiction symptoms or, dependent symptoms.
So I think that it's a really important point. So ADHD medication, not addictive. And like, we are a community who forget to take our meds, who have to have systems to remind us to take our meds in the morning. How many cigarette smokers do you know who forget to take that, have their first cigarette? I mean, it just doesn't happen.
The hallmark difference there was two: craving and withdrawal effects, particularly craving. I've never had a patient crave their medication like someone would crave a cigarette. That's a really good example, actually, right?
Yeah.
They will actually forget to take their meds. But
you can't forget if you've got a craving. Like, that's not
forget.
And I think, and to anyone who's, so I think it's just a very important point in terms of I'd say the withdrawal, I recognize the two parts of that, the sort of withdrawal effects and the cravings. I mean, there are medications which have withdrawal effects, which are not addictive, but they have withdrawal effects, and you have to manage that very carefully.
I think there's one thing that I do want to add on this substance misuse point, which or addiction. Actually, there's a lot of data that shows if you have undiagnosed, untreated ADHD, and you're not treated in one way or the other, there is an increased likelihood that you will become addicted to substances over your lifespan.
And not the research I've seen in particular says that your risk of the of severe addiction is much higher. So the probability of you being in the category who have severe addiction with really significant life impacts is much, much higher. And certainly when I think about people with ADHD and myself, I'm, you know, like, not only are you, with particularly with the impulsivity, more likely to try a substance, but you are significantly less able to deal with the consequences. Yeah. And you're significantly more likely to be in the severe camp and therefore be dealing with more consequences than others. And so just to emphasize, steer away, like, you know, particularly when we're talking around young people, and there's been a lot of drugs education, which is, well, talking particularly when I was a kid, which was like, take drugs and die. You will die and you'll be dead. Like, that's you. You take the drugs, dead. And then you see a friend do it, and you're like, they didn't die. Like, something's up here. Like, people telling me all the truth. And that obviously then undermines that whole thing. And I think, and particularly though, if you're seeing, you know, in your own life, people taking drugs and not having, you know, seemingly, you know, particularly, you know, that's not you. Like, that path, like, is not for you. It's only my mother gave me her. I got sat down for the drug chat, and what she said was, if I was watching this about to get to the world, was like, you need to know that drugs are fun, and they have a they have a fun impact, but you forget how to have fun elsewhere. You lose the ability to have fun with in other ways, but also particularly the ways of longer term fun, of doing well and succeeding, and with friends and family in that same way. It takes those away from you, and it's a really high price to pay. And that one worked for me, was one that hit home. Whereas the "you'll die" one, like, I was at the point where friends were not, you know, not dying.
Aren't we seeing the same thing with ADHD meds, right? Many, many years ago, and look.
Well, take the medications and die.
I'm talking from a media perspective. I'm not going to call out all media outlets. They're really good. But are we not seeing that same initial reaction to something that's potentially new or whatever? It's not new. It's been around for years. But same thing. We're seeing that set. There's that initial absolutely horrendous response to something until you have enough people. Why are people taking ADHD medication? It's because it's bloody effective. Probably one of the most effective psychotropic medications that exists, right?
When you say psychotropic, what do you mean?
Mental health medications, right?
So I think that's a really important thing to say. So one of the reasons is ADHD medication is one of the most effective medications for a mental condition. Like, it's a big deal.
Very big deal. Look, antidepressants have an effectiveness of about 50%. Now, disclaimer again, antidepressants are very useful in patients with severe clinical depression and anxiety. I'm not saying you shouldn't use them when they're needed. However, if you look at that statistic, that's flipping a coin. Right?
Yeah, but a coin worth flipping, right? I think that's your point, right?
A coin worth flipping in the right place, right? But
yeah, for those people. Yeah.
The right thing. You have ADHD symptoms, right? And you're taking a stimulant medication. 7 to 8 out of 10 people are going to tell you, and I see this in my practice, there is a significant improvement in my symptoms, in my functioning, etc., and where it plays out in life. Over time, what will happen is, and this is already happening, more and more patients are going to be coming to their GP saying, and I know this because I speak to GP colleagues, do you know what? This has been transformative for me. So those patients that get coming back to the GP again and again and again with their problems, and we didn't really know what was going on, suddenly are not needing to do that anymore. And over time, that wave gets bigger, because then people will start to say, at least professionals will start to say, hang on a minute. Okay, there's something about this, right? Because it's clearly working. And over time, it will become less and less of this big taboo. And then people can actually see the benefits for what they are, you know? So
I think every mental health condition, disorder, and we obviously are a disorder, not a condition, but like I think a lot of us prefer to say condition because we hate the word disorder. you see them go along a journey. Like, so for example, depression, 20 years ago, you talked about depression, people would say, you consider turning that smile upside down. Like, if you smile at the world, it'll smile back at you. And that was genuine advice, right, 20 years ago. Like, it was like,
but also, do you not remember, I remember this, Prozac, right? That company, I mean, I don't know the history of it, but I remember the general theme was that, oh, you know, in America, these drug companies are just making big money, right? Out of Prozac is fluoxetine, basically, right? Antidepressant, SSRI antidepressant. But for, I mean, prior to my ADHD kind of, most of my practice is now ADHD, of course. But in general sort of psychiatry, I've met many patients with true severe clinical depression and anxiety throughout their lifespan. And it's in their family, there's strong genetic history, et cetera, et cetera. It's been that they wouldn't, sugarcoat this. They might have taken their own lives without that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but at the time there was all this taboo about everyone's making money out of this, right? What we're not seeing is, well, but how many lives have been saved, right? What's been the burden of not treating this, which is massive, right? Health, financial, relationships, you name it, right? Everything gets impacted if you're not treating this. And it's chronic condition. It's always sadly there, right?
Yeah.
So,
and obviously this is exactly the same for ADHD.
Same thing that's happening here. We've had this in history about everything, you know, even beyond medicine. When something, you know, innovative came in, there was so much criticism, right? Until over time where you're like, well, no, that's actually, that might have some use, you know? And then you start to look at the benefits of things. This is the natural sort of evolution of human history and everything. So it's not surprising.
So I think very important that we've covered that, you know, that it's impactful, that it's that it's not addictive, and that we're not going towards an opioid crisis. And to be very clear on that. We are out of time, so we're going to need to pick this one up. We will pick up with what was question number two, which was describe each of the medications and what they do. Well, so yeah. We got to question one. Tune back in for question two, and we, you know, who knows, we might get to question three. Dr. Mushi, you've been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And I look forward to us picking this up. It is a huge topic. It's very, very important. And one of the things, this is called deep dive. And the reason is we're not curtailing by a certain amount of time, we're curtailing by answering the question properly. And that's where we're stopping at. So that's the goal of this. These are for people who want to know more, and we're trying to provide that more. You've been wonderful. I truly appreciate it. Thank you very much, Dr. Mashu. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
And that's our signing out for this one. Got to do the bit. Remember, we're a charity. We get no funds from government. We live on a financial knife's edge. So do consider donating or fundraising. It's incredibly important. We can only do this and everything else with your support. Thank you. Yeah, look forward to hopefully joining next time. And thank you again.